The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 26th of April, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Stephen Williams, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rehoboth Resources, RBD, ticker there. And Stephen talks about drilling operations, which have started at their West Newton appraisal well onshore UK. Also on the podcast, Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer at Predator Oil and Gas, PRD, is ticker there. And Paul discusses the significance of the prospective resource update on their onshore Morocco permits. Plus, I have Dr. Jackie Mitchell, VP of Regulatory Affairs and Quality at Shield Therapeutics, STX, is the ticker there. And Dr. Jackie talks about the granting of a major extension in Switzerland for their lead product, Ferricrew. Also on the podcast, I have Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell, talking about the positive US earnings season, but how it's not as straightforward as it seems, and how the outlook isn't as rosy. Plus, he also covers the following stocks: SNU, Walker Greenback, and RPS. Plus, I also have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a host, reams of other content. What we got here? We got Spotlight, the rollout of 5G. It's an interview there Anita's done. Rehoboth Resources and Union Jack Oil launched West Newton Drill onshore. That's Anita there as well. From Abraham, got an article on Prospect Oil and Gas and United Oil and Gas, and how Prospect's shares rally basically on that news. Zach taking stock. There's loads of other stuff there. Just go there at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Stephen Williams, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rehoboth Resources, RBD. His ticker there. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin.
Now, you've announced today a well commencement at West Newton. That's onshore UK, of course. And we'll delve into details of this, the facts and figures, in a bit. Before we do, as always, even for someone listening not familiar with the company, can you explain or summarise what Rehoboth is all about, please?
Yeah, of course. So Rehoboth was set up around about 18 months ago, where Sachin, my co-chief executive, and myself joined the company with a kind of new strategy in the sector. And really, this involves funding other operators' appraisal wells. Mm-hmm. So what we seek to do is find high-quality, de-risked assets that are valued lowly and have difficulty in accessing capital because they're still in the pre-cash flow stage of their life cycle. And we look at assets in which we can provide the funding that takes that asset onto the next stage and generates a revaluation. So we believe there are a lot of these around the world. We see a lot of these projects that fit into that criteria. So we've built up a nice portfolio within Rehoboth of interests in other operators' appraisal projects. We've drilled multiple wells already. Most of them have been successful. So very pleased with the way the strategy is playing out so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's talk about West Newton. It's quite an exciting and, you know, it's significant, isn't it? And there's lots of sort of dimensions to this that are quite exciting here. And let's delve into it. Tell us how you've started, how long is it going to take, and what's the upside for you, etc. And we'll talk a bit more after that.
Yeah, okay, so just to put the quantification on it to start off with then. So there's really two elements here. There's the appraisal of a gas discovery that was made in 2014, and then there's an additional oil exploration target which will be tested by the same well. The gas appraisal is really the main target from the Rehoboth perspective because that's the sort of asset that fits exactly into the strategy that I described before. But we have the opportunity here to test the oil as well. It doesn't cost a lot more money to deepen the well and go for the oil. And the oil is a really, you know, game-changing type discovery if that comes in. So in this case, we're very excited about having the opportunity to test that in addition to the gas appraisal well. Now, the MPVs that we put out in the RNS today associated with these projects on a gross basis are around about $250 million for that low-risk gas appraisal and about $850 million for the oil target. And Rheobald has an effective economic interest of about 25% in this project. So you can see that these NPVs are extremely meaningful relative to the size of Rheobald today. So there's a lot of scale here with these assets, and also a very high chance of success, particularly on the gas appraisal. So, you know, the management estimate from the operator is a 72% chance of success mm-hmm. on the gas well, which is extremely high, as anybody who follows the sector will know. Clearly more risk associated with the oil exploration. That's more like a 24% chance of success. But, you know, we're extremely excited about the gas in particular. It really fits into everything that makes the Rheobald strategy tick.
Yeah, so it is. And I do think sometimes when I see private investors talking about, you know, the NPVs on projects, they never look at the chance of success. And sometimes you get a high impact, you know, exploration well, and they just assume it's a done deal almost, you know, when it's a 10 to 1 or more chance of success. Whereas here, you're odds on, which is a big difference. You know, if you go over that 50% level, that's a big difference. It means there's an odds on chance you achieving that. And what's that NPV around 46, 47 million? Is it? Is that right?
Pounds? Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, this really speaks to why we set up Rheobald in the first place. So we've got this strange situation in the industry where project that should be getting funding for the last few years hasn't been able to get it. Mm-hmm. Now, it's always difficult to get funding for a 1 in 10 chance of success exploration well. Mm-hmm. For the reason you point out, it's probably not going to work.
Yeah.
Now, what happened in this case is the team, and this is the same team that we're still working with now, they're operating this asset, the team behind Rathlin drilled two exploration wells in 2014, the second one of which was the West Newton discovery. So they've sort of done the hard bit, which is make that initial discovery, which is, you know, always odds against you point of activity. Mm-hmm. Once you've made the first discovery, the subsequent appraisal well is the one that clearly should be funded because that's the much lower risk target.
Yeah.
So everything about this asset was going really well. The company made the discovery. It's clearly of huge scale, fantastic economics associated with it. You're in a market in the UK that clearly needs the gas. It's in a fantastic location within the UK as well. The only problem with this was this happened in 2014, right about the time the oil price absolutely collapsed. Mm-hmm. And that is when funding completely disappeared for these kind of projects. So they just didn't have the funding available to drill this appraisal well. And it's taken until 2019, with Rheobald's involvement, along with Union Jack and Humber, who have come alongside as partners in the well, to actually get this thing drilled, despite the fact it looks so compelling from both a value and a chance of success perspective.
Yeah, well, take us through the timeline of events here, because I know you say overall, you know, to the both targets are 40 days, but we expect news before then?
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, roughly 40 days for the entire drilling operation, but clearly, you know, we're going through multiple targets. There are various, you know, elements to the drilling program, so we are likely to see initial results before that, and anything that is deemed announceable will be announced, you know, at the time we get that information.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, marvelous stuff. So it's quite exciting start of a project here that could be transformational, you know. So for someone listening, Stephen, first of all, tell us about the location of where it is, because I know sometimes there's been issues of late onshore. There's been a couple of councils, but tell us about the location here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, onshore UK is not the easiest place in the world to work from a regulatory perspective, you know, and there's often elements of protest, etc., which makes things more difficult. And people may have seen that in other companies that are drilling onshore in the UK. So we fully understand that and respect that. What we would say about this, though, is I don't think you could find a better place to locate a major gas discovery onshore the UK than we are here. So this is in the Humber Valley. It's kind of not too far from Hull. It's an area with a lot of industrial activity going on. So you've got, you know, gas-fired power generation nearby. You've got an oil refinery very nearby. And crucially, you've got a huge amount of gas infrastructure in the area. So the Easington import terminal, where a lot of the sort of southern North Sea gas comes into the UK, is very close by. You've got major pipelines running through the license and nearby. You've got gas storage facilities in the area. So if you're going to make a gas discovery onshore in the UK, I don't think we'd prefer to put it anywhere than it actually is.
Yeah, so the community, and it's very much oil and gas industry focused, you know, so it's really geared up towards that, isn't it? So, you know, you're in a good place. Okay, Steve, three reasons, if someone's listening right now, if they're not following the story, three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, well, firstly, just to emphasize again, I mean, this, if in the event of success, will be one of the most significant UK onshore oil and gas projects in many, many years. So I think that alone is certainly a reason for people to be keeping an eye on Rehobald today. But I guess the second reason, I touched on it earlier, we've got a full portfolio of assets that look, you know, similar to this, that we're already active in California, offshore UK, and in Romania as well. We've been involved in 6 wells to date. I don't think there's many other companies of our sort of size that offer the same level and consistency of activity that we do. So that's the six wells that have already been drilled before this one since autumn last year, the majority of which have been discoveries. So we have this deep portfolio of assets, and I think there's always another interesting drilling event to look forward to. And that kind of ties in, I guess, the third point is the specific assets that we've got line of sight on new drilling on coming up. So after this one, the plan is then to drill our first well in Romania, and that's a really exciting well again. And I think success there really launches a whole new business in Romania. And then we also have the Grizzly Island project to drill in California. We've drilled 4 wells in California across 2 other fields. Grizzly is the largest single resource that we've got, a very exciting well, and we'll be drilling that hopefully later on this year.
Marvellous stuff, Stephen. Like I said, good to chat, and very busy, lots of news coming up. So no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Absolutely, thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of Predator Oil and Gas. That's PRD, ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin.
Now, you heard some decent news out yesterday on a technical update in Morocco there and a CPR, and the share price reacted nicely to that, and we'll get into the detail of that. But before we do, Paul, as always, you're not just about Morocco. In fact, you've got a lot of other things going on at the moment. So give us a quick summary. Predator Oil and Gas, what's it all about, please?
Okay, so the company is focused on being a responsible fossil fuel exploration and production company. We include our emphasis on gas, which is lower CO2 emissions compared to oil, and enhanced oil recovery, where CO2 can be at the same time sequestrated in the ground. And I think that's very important in the current climate, which faces the industry and the industry in the oil and gas sector in general. Mm-hmm. So Morocco, Trinidad and Ireland satisfy these objectives and provide us also with near-term production opportunities, exploration opportunities, and also M&A transaction opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so yesterday you received a prospective resource update on your onshore Moroccan permits. Could you take us through the detail there, Paul, please?
Yeah, I mean, obviously everybody hopefully has read the RNS yesterday, but the objective was to summarise our CPR for Guercif and to illustrate independently the huge potential for gas in this license adjacent to infrastructure. So it confirms the attractiveness of the Moroccan gas market, mm-hmm. and also supports the geological comparison in the to the producing Rahb Basin gas fields, where the discovery rate for gas is actually remarkably high. So the numbers, in terms of the numbers, the unrisked net predator gas resources are up to 943 BCF in the high case, and that generates an unrisked NPV of over $831 million. But I think this only tells half the story, and I think it's important that people understand the next point. Because of the low development costs for gas discovery here, and also the high potential well deliverabilities, the high in-country gas prices, and a very attractive tax regime, I mean, it's intuitively obvious that these projects, in a success case, are going to generate very, very high internal rates of returns, IRRs, and potentially in the order of 500 to 600% for a large gas discovery. Now, you bear this in the context that the industry norm is 15 to 25%, and you can understand, and this is based, view of IRR is based also on the unrisked NPV of $1.95 million for BCF, which was quoted in the CPR. So it's obvious that by any industry norm or standard, this is an exceptional project economically in a success case, and that's bound to attract larger entities in the event we are fortunate enough to have a discovery with the first well. And then, again, to pull that into context, to capture this opportunity requires a $2 million well. I mean, that is, in my view, unbelievable in terms of the investment versus the potential reward.
Yeah.
And I think that's point is generally missed when you read the RNS, because you don't think in terms of the economic success of the project, but by all measures and standards, this would be an exceptional, potentially an exceptional internal rate of return. And that's going to make it attractive to big players.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got this. So what's next? What's going for? What's next now, Paul, here?
Well, the next step is, which we're currently looking at, is rig options. Mm-hmm. And also the timing of drilling, and to make sure that effectively overlaps and coincides with the generation of production income from Trinidad. So, you know, that's the next priority for us. But also as part of that process, there is also the environmental impact assessment that has to be done with any drilling opportunity anywhere in the world these days. And that's a very important box to tick, because if you're attracting potential investment from farminees, et cetera, then you need to tick the environmental regulatory box before you actually consummate a deal with them. Because that makes it much more attractive knowing that for them, knowing that, you know, that box is ticked. Mm-hmm. So it's not difficult to see why we're so excited by Morocco and Kosif. You know, for a small company, this is what exploration is all about. You know, it's almost akin to winning the lottery in a success case. And that obviously generates the opportunity for a trade sale, and then we can run off and repeat the model elsewhere, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, well, you know, it's, like I said, there's huge potential there. Morocco, it's all going well, it's progressing, and like I said, the economics are very attractive, and the jurisdiction as well, you know, lends itself nicely to development. So, but that's not the only thing you've got going on. So you've got Trinidad as well, you've got Ireland. So what's happening in Trinidad, Paul?
So in Trinidad, we've just completed a visit out there to make sure everything's on track, which it is, for the CO2 EOR production before the end of H1 this year, before the end of June. And both ourselves and Columbus are working very much together on this now to deliver this project, which potentially has obviously major implications for increasing onshore production. So what was interesting in Trinidad was the fact that Heritage, which is the new creation out of Petrochin, has mentioned this project in the Trinidad press. So that kind of uplifts our profile in Trinidad and potentially creates additional news flow opportunities. But it's a sign of how important to Heritage this project is as well. And that's important to us because Heritage, by far the bulk of the remaining reserves in Trinidad. So if we can make this successful, then that kind of cements our relationship with Heritage in terms of looking at upscaling this, and not just in this field, but in other fields in Trinidad. So that's a very important piece of news flow for us in the Trinidad press.
Yeah.
So in Ireland, we are working on the competent persons report for Ramhead, which we in the Celtic Sea, which we mentioned in the last announcement. Hopefully that'll be out in due course. And I think the market will be very pleased by what they may see in that CPR. I think it'll be very well received. And it cements the position, I think, of what we've always said pre-CPR, is that Ramhead represents the largest undeveloped gas discovery offshore Ireland. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Scenic look as though they're going to execute their well this year offshore in the Porcupine, well, they will get the approvals to do that. That's the rumour at present. Obviously, that would be a tremendous fillip for the offshore Ireland, that a major oil company is actually executing a well this year. So we believe that will stimulate M&A transaction in Ireland, and Ramhead would be an obvious asset for any major taking a new look at Ireland after the Scenic Weld is executed.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's lots of risk involved, you know, sort of drilling and funding as well. But when you see the potential of what you could have compared to what you're valued at now, it's laughable, really, isn't it?
All oil and gas explorers are undervalued in the early days. But we believe, and of course we would say this, you know that, but we believe we are very, very, very much undervalued, given the fact that we've got three great projects, all of which could be transformation of the company. So it's easy to see why, you know, you would, or we are very happy as the bigger shareholders, management in the company, to keep our interests at our current levels in the company, because we see the opportunity for growth in the share price as being absolutely exceptional. And we've already seen at least a 200% increase on the IPO price. So, for example, when my relationship manager at my bank asked me about investments, I say to him, well, can you generate me a 200% rate of return in a year? And he says, well, no, that's pretty difficult. And I said, well, yeah, well, there you go then. So bye-bye, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you have to put it in that context. Now, it's high risk. Of course it's high risk. Everything in oil and gas at this stage is high risk. But, you know, it's high reward. And that's the key for small companies. You only invest in small companies if you accept the risk, but also accept that there is massive upside, like no other investment at present in any other sector. You wouldn't get this level of potential upside.
Exactly. You should show your bank manager your chart. I mean, you started off to run about two and a half pence, and it's gone up to sort of 13 pence.
Yeah. So he doesn't believe my charts, you know. So I have to actually tie him to the desk and say, look, here, you can look at it online.
Yeah. Well, do you know, and I think what private investors have to understand, and the more sophisticated do, is that there's always place for high-risk oil and gas, but you just have to make sure that your exposure to that one stock is not massive. It's, you know, you manage your portfolio risk, and that's it. And, you know, because there's
You manage the portfolio risk, but you also have diversification both by country and by asset. And I think, you know, we have a beautifully balanced portfolio of three projects in three very reliable jurisdictions in some cases, very, 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 very good fiscal terms. In other cases, very, very good commodity prices. And for instance, in Trinidad, oil prices have increased by nearly 30% over the last few months. So, you know, we will get the benefit of that when we're producing our oil, you know. So timing is everything. Getting your production on stream during a rising oil price is very, very important too. So.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, Paul, in summary, quickly, three bullet points why someone who's not following you should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, first and foremost, that has to be Morocco and Guercif. I mean, that offers an early opportunity to drill at a very low cost with the potential for what I believe is a truly exceptional internal rate of return, compared to, as I said, the industry norm of 15 to 25%. So in a success case with that well, this makes it very attractive for a trade sale to a larger entity. Secondly, Trinidad offers early production and cash flow in 2019 to capitalize on the recent, as I said, 30% rise in oil prices. So That's the timing is absolutely right for Trinidad production. And lastly, you know, if CEO managed to execute their well in Ireland this year, we think that will be a major milestone for the Irish offshore sector, and that could be the catalyst for M&A transactions in Ireland. And Ramhead is well suited, you know, in terms of fitting that portfolio of potential M&A transactions. As I've said, it's the largest undeveloped gas discovery in Ireland.
Marvellous stuff. Paul, good to chat to you. Like you say, lots going on, so no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Yeah, probably pretty soon. Okay.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Jackie Mitchell, VP of Regulatory Affairs and Quality at Shield Therapeutics at STX Ticker. Jackie, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here.
Yes, well, it's good to have you on. And we've had, obviously, the guys on from Shield before, and lots of potential there. But for people not aware, not familiar with Shield Therapeutics, can you just explain or summarise what the business is about, please, Jackie?
Yes, of course. Shield is a small specialty pharma company focused on delivering products to address unmet medical needs. These type of products are typically prescribed by hospital doctors rather than GPs. Shield was co-founded in 2008 by Carl Starrett. He remains the CEO of the company today. It's UK-based and we have offices in both London and Newcastle. Our lead product, Ferrocru, was launched in 2016 in the UK and in Germany.
Wow, you're a professional, Dr. Jackie. You know, we know Carl very well. Carl's been on many a time and no doubt very busy today. So give us a bit of background about yourself, if you could, Dr. Jackie.
Sure. So I've been in pharma for more than 25 years, definitely much longer than I care to admit. I started off in big pharma, much as all of the Shield management team have. And I've worked for companies such as Abbott and J&J in both European and global regulatory affairs across a wide range of therapeutic areas. I've gradually moved down in size, and in recent years, I've worked primarily for SMEs and startups. And as you've already said, I look after both quality and regulatory at Shield. I've been with Shield since the early days. I joined in 2011, just as the pivotal clinical trials were beginning. So I'm really proud to have been a key driver of the regulatory strategy, as well as inputting into the overall commercial strategy for the company.
Yeah, it must be good to see that development from start to where you are now. Let's talk about your lead product, Ferrocru, which just received a major extension to approval in Switzerland. Can you tell us more, firstly, about Ferrocru and what this extension means to its patients in Switzerland and as a market opportunity as Shield, you know, overall?
Yes, indeed. So Ferrocru is a novel oral iron product. It provides a much needed and a well-tolerated alternative to IV iron therapy for patients with anemia. It contains iron complex with maltol, and the maltol coats the iron as it journeys through the gut, which means that Ferrocru can be taken by patients with anemia associated with conditions such as inflammatory bowel disease, who typically can't take traditional iron tablets because of the gastro side effects, and these include stomach pains, nausea, constipation, and sometimes diarrhea. So these patients have to be given IV iron, which is both costly, inconvenient, requires administration in hospital, and there's a small risk of something called anaphylaxis, which is an extreme form of allergic reaction, which can actually be life-threatening. Furthermore, in between injections, these patients begin to feel more and more unwell, whereas a daily Ferrocru pill maintains constant iron levels and prevents the reoccurrence of symptoms such as fatigue.
Yeah, okay.
As you mentioned, we've recently, this week, been given positive news from Swissmedic. And Ferrocru was initially approved in both the EU and Switzerland for a very specific group of patients that were studied in our clinical program. These were patients with anemia and inflammatory bowel disease who couldn't tolerate oral iron products. Once we had initial feedback from the commercial setting confirming the safety and the effectiveness of Ferrocru in this, if you like, worst case scenario population, and the difference it was making to the quality of life for these patients, we applied to have the indication significantly broadened to patients with iron deficiency, both with and without anemia, and regardless of the underlying cause of the iron deficiency. And the extension was supported by the Scientific Committee of the European Medicines Agency and approved in the EU in 2018. So we're very pleased indeed that Swissmedic have followed suit and they've agreed to the same broad indication in Switzerland.
Yeah. And you recently also published some positive results in your Aegis head-to-head inferiority study. Now, could you tell us a little bit more about that and what this means for Shield, your partners and patients, please, Dr. Jackie?
Yes, of course. So the head-to-head study was conducted in several countries across Europe, Belgium, Germany, France, Spain and Hungary. And it compared Foracru with a leading brand of IV iron in the treatment of anemia, again, in patients with inflammatory bowel disease. The IV iron was used according to normal medical practice approved in the countries in the trial. And the results confirmed that Foracru was as effective as IV iron in increasing hemoglobin levels in these patients. And this finding was very important both for physicians and patients, as it confirms that Foracru really does shift the treatment paradigm away from IV iron. But it also supports our European partners, Norgine and Ewell Pharma, in reimbursement discussions with regulatory authorities across Europe as they implement the rollout. So it's an important milestone for us in achieving our geographical expansion for the product.
Yeah, okay. Well, Jackie, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of Shield Therapeutics, but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons, please, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please?
Right. So, well, as you know, we had a very difficult start to 2018 when we saw our share price plummet to below 20p. Over the last 12 months, the Shield team has consistently delivered with a consequential steady rise in share price. However, there's still a number of important inflection points coming up in the next 6 months. That includes the US approval, which we expect around the end of July. And finally, and perhaps most importantly for a patient-centric company such as ourselves, the feedback from patients and physicians alike confirm that Foracru really is a great product and it really does make a difference to patients' lives.
Marvellous stuff. Dr. Jackie, thanks for coming on and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you, my friend?
Yes, not too bad. You good. Refreshed and, you know, back at your desk now, ready to go?
Yeah, I've had a couple of weeks off, which was great, and then got back just in time for the Easter weekend, so that sort of helped ease me back in. So, yeah, very much batteries recharged, and I'm ready to go now, I'm pleased to say.
Yeah, isn't it funny how sentiment in the markets change? I felt like Q4 last year, you know, we were all heading to recession, the yield curve was tipping up there, everything was going wrong, and all of a sudden now it's looking a little bit better. I mean, from what I gather, in America, they'd all lowered their estimates for this quarter earnings, and they've all come in above those lowered estimates, so they're all quite happy now. So everything's a bit more bullish, isn't it?
It seems to be. I mean, that's part of the, you know, expectations management is a key skill for any executive team of a public company, and I think, you know, the Americans are particularly good at it, and they have to be because they've got quarterly results.
Yeah.
How on earth you run a company on the basis of making a quarterly number, I have absolutely no idea. It must be very stressful. You know, it's probably bad enough doing it for interims and full year figures, let alone, you know, quarterly.
Yeah.
And I think overall, yes, I think the generally companies are beating, but I still think you're getting earnings coming in down year on year in the first quarter, and then people are putting in a big hockey stick for the second half of the year, helped by the Fed not raising interest rates, helped by hopes, and I stress hopes, for a US-China trade deal, and hopes that, you know, that sort of wobble that we had late on last year was just a bit of a sticky soft patch. It's interesting. One of the key barometers I use for this, we've talked about it before, is the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, the SOX, because silicon chips are pretty much everywhere you look. Your smartphone, your tablet, your laptop, your car, your fridge, your smart meter, whatever it happens to be, they've got silicon chips in them, so they're a great proxy for economic growth. They're also, and the SOX index is a great proxy for market risk appetite, because these are momentum stocks. They feed off earnings upgrades. They fear earnings downgrades. And the SOX got murdered in the second half of last year, and it's rallied about 30% this year to get to a new all-time high. Now, if you look at what the chippy chappies have been saying, they've all been talking this story of, first half's going to be tough, but don't worry, baby, it'll all be okay in the second half. And that's been a constant theme, and that's helped companies like Micron and quite a lot of others get through that sort of, oh my goodness, the growth scare. But this week, Texas Instruments, and then yesterday, Xilinx, and yesterday, Intel, the granddaddy of them all, have all said, you know what? second half's not looking quite as good as we thought it was going to. And so in that respect, I think we've got to be a little bit careful here in that, yes, there's lots of macro enthusiasm. You get the talking heads on CNBC and other commentators saying, look, you know, second half upturn, da-da-da-da. But you're just getting the first signs from companies actually in the front line are just saying, might not be that simple. So I'm not saying, you know, that they're wrong, that the bull case is wrong that's carried stocks higher this year, but I'm saying be very careful because it's not, I don't think, as clear-cut as markets are making out. Now, let's face it, there's the old rule, you can have cheap stocks and good news, not both at the same time, yeah? So in the fourth quarter of last year, loads of bad news, surprise, surprise, things got cheaper, few bargains came up and stocks have rallied. Now you've got everybody telling you actually everything's hunky-dory, la-di-da, and everything has gone up a long way. I would suggest that risk-reward is now more balanced towards risk than reward, at least in the short term.
Yeah, well, I know Amazon came out. Listen to this figure here. This is crazy, really. So net profit in a three-month period, of course, this is, of $3.56 billion, right? So, now, I worked this out. That's around £30 million profit per day, all right, which is equal to $1.2 million per hour, which is equal to 21 grand per second, which is more in a second than someone, say, earning the national living wage gets in a year. That's a phenomenal amount of money per second. 20 over 20 grand of profit per second. That is crazy, isn't it? But even they said the outlook isn't that good.
They'd actually substantially downgraded Q1 estimates, saying they were going to spend a lot more, and then they didn't spend as much as they thought. So you could say there's a bit of expectations management going on there, but actually Amazon, I think, is one of those few companies that actually doesn't give a monkey's about short-term earnings and managing expectations. And I just don't think they do. And their history shows that the numbers are all over the place. You know, most companies, when they beat, maybe they or miss, they maybe, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cents. This company beats and misses by 50 cents or a dollar. And they just don't care. They're focused on the long term, and that has paid off so far. And that's possibly why people are being relatively forgiving of another guy down for the second quarter, with them going for next day delivery worldwide. That's going to be an $800 million investment. They're saying that's going to depress short-term profits. And right now, the market's in a pretty forgiving mood. But just one thing, and please, dear listeners, I'm neither Justin nor I are going to suggest that this is going to happen again. But don't forget that during the 2000 to 2003 bear market, Amazon stock went down by 90%.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
Don't forget. Yeah.
To be honest, at the time, the internet was still, people were still questioning whether they had commercial sort of viability.
Sure.
I saw an interview with Jeff Bezos, an old one, where this guy was saying, are you a tech company or what? And he said, well, it doesn't matter. We are customer focused. And he said, no, and the interview said, well, it does for investors because tech was all the thing at the time. He said, no, it doesn't. He said, I'm focused on the customer. That's true.
I think that's been one of the great, and that's why, again, he doesn't care about short term earnings.
Yeah.
He does care about the customer. And I think that attitude is being, now, you know, the company's market cap is back to nearly $1 trillion. Am I saying it's going to go back to 100 million? 100 billion? No, I'm not. But I'm saying that, you know, if risk appetite wobbles and Amazon has a couple of quarters when things don't quite pan out, you might get a less friendly response than one you've had now. Equally, the issue that you've got, you know, why have things swung around so much from December to April? I think, unfortunately, a lot of it down to central banks. And I say unfortunately because I don't like them being center stage because I'm a bottom-up kind of guy, right? Stocks, you know, stock markets are about stocks as far as I'm concerned, and not about central bank policy and passing statements and whether they've taken one word in or put one word out. But since the Fed on the 4th of January basically said no interest rate increases this year, and then in March followed that up by saying we're going to stop quantitative tightening in September, everything's changed because everybody was assuming that interest rates would keep on going up. That would mean that cash and bonds were actually more of a viable alternative to equities, particularly if you were reaching for yield. Now, with the Fed saying interest rates flat, the market's actually pricing in a 57% chance of a cut in the US this year. You're almost back to Tina. There is no alternative when it comes to stocks because bond yields have gone back down, improved returns on cash aren't going back up. And in the wake of the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Reserve Bank of Australia, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, central banks in Taiwan, Philippines, Sweden, Japan, just yesterday, all said no interest rate increase for the rest of the year. And again, that is why you've had this upsurge in enthusiasm for equities and to a degree for bonds, because central banks are not raising rates anywhere near as quickly as anybody thought. And if anything, the Aussies and the Kiwis have suggested the next move is going to be down. So you're slightly back to TINA. There is no alternative. Tina. particularly if you're looking for yield and yield. You know, equities are going up, junk bonds are going up. So people, again, are being forced up the risk curve. Now, that will get you so far, but in the end, if the earnings don't come through, we've still potentially got a challenge going forward. So that's why it's important, as we just go back to where we started, do keep an eye on fundamentals, because I know it's tempting to think, oh, don't fight the Fed. But don't forget that in 2000 to 2003, in 2007 to 2009, central banks were cutting interest rates left, right and center, having initially said, no recession here, move along, nothing to worry about. And A, they were wrong, and B, markets went down anyway. So I'm not saying, again, everything's about to drop in a hole, but I am saying it's the old Buffett thing. Be fearful when others are greedy and be greedy when others are fearful. And right now, people have gone from being very fearful in December to a little bit more greedy this spring, you know, as you've seen from some of the IPO valuations that have been coming out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, let's talking about saying in a favour of stocks, it's a market of stocks. Let's look at some stocks.
Yeah, let's look at three. S&U, which is one we've not looked at before. Walker Green Bank, which is one that we have. And then, since I know the income theme is strong and we're nibbling about with that, another one we've not looked at before, RPS.
Yeah, okay. S&U, what's all that about?
S&U. S-U-S is the ticker. It's a FTSE small cap stock based in Solihull, market cap about £270 million. It's a motor finance and specialist property lender. It basically, it's Advantage Business, offers subprime loans for cars, and Aspen offers loans to commercial borrowers who are looking to refurbish or buy commercial properties. So people might think immediately, what? A lender in the UK? Cars? Property? No, thank you very much, because if unemployment goes up and the economy turns down, there are substantial risks here. And I completely get that. And that is one of the reasons why the stock was an absolute horror last year, or the share price was at least. The banks, this is an area, though, where the banks just don't play. So they have a niche. And this is a family-run business since 1938. So it does tend to lend pretty prudently. And if you look at the full-year figures in March, lending actually was down 8%. Collections were up 25% and car transactions were down 14%. The bit of the business that was growing was Aspen. That actually grew 60% year on year, and it broke even in just its second year of business. They've got 160 million of borrowing they can do. They've only borrowed 108, so there's plenty of headroom there, but they're doing it very, very carefully. Company's grown its dividend for more than 10 years. And I think if you are looking for any danger signals with a stock, watch for loan impairments. There was a small increase last year. And if nothing else, if you're looking for a sort of a litmus test or a lead indicator for the UK economy, this company, Morse's Club, which you've also talked about, Provident Financial, these are the companies that you'd be looking for, because they're right at the front line, you know, doorstep lending, subprime lending. And if they see loans start to go sour, that will be the first sign that the UK consumer is feeling stress. You're not seeing that particularly right now. There was only a small increase last year. Again, the dividend record, growth record's very good. And the company is on a PE of 9. The shares are on a PE of 9 with a yield of about 5.5%. Yield's decently covered. So your worry really is the UK economy, because I don't think these people are going to lend in any way imprudently. I mean, the average car loan is about £6,000 and it's repaid over 4 years. So I think this is a stock where, again, you've had loads of bad news because of the UK economy and the B word and everything else. But there's been no bad news in numbers yet and the shares look cheap. So either for income or for capital gains, I think there are potentially. But yeah, keep an eye on it, because if loans start to go sour here, it could be a big read-through for the rest of the UK economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And
what does the chart tell you?
Well, do you know what? It's become ugly of late. It's in this year was. Since it was up at 27, you know, 20, yeah. or £28, sorry, and it's come down to 18, bounced off
there
that level
go.
Up to 21. But it's hit its head on the 200-day moving average, which is, as everyone knows, or most people may know.
Certainly
is,
technicals,
the technical, that's the bull bear line, that's the biggest moving average that people look at. So if it gets above that, it's probably quite bullish. But I shouldn't think that aggressive bounce up, it's got to retest the low a bit. It'll come back.
Probably right.
Because it's risen fast in the last few sessions. Okay, and it's overbought as well in the RSI. Cool, what's next, Ross?
Walker Green Bank, WGBA, 50 million cap, based in Uxbridge. Now, we looked at this last November. It was at 77p, thinking it was a turnaround story, and it promptly went to about 50p. So it was like, However, the shares have thankfully bounced back to 70-odd, so fingers crossed I wasn't completely off beam. Remember, this is a luxury wallpaper, fabrics and furnishings business, where so much had gone wrong. Factory floods, the UK economy, a dividend cut, the CEO had gone, But I just felt there was a turnaround potential here because it's got terrific brands, Harlequin, Zoffany. It's all sold through John Lewis and all the right kind of, you know, people. It's got a strong demographic and there's very little debt in the business. Just £1.9 million, although there is, I must stress, a £10 million pension deficit. Now, a new CEO has come in, Lisa Montagu. She's immediately targeting further cost efficiencies and is focusing on the licensing business and international. And then the full year figures came out, actually, when I was away on holiday. No new nasties. Hurrah. Okay. And also for the first quarter, for the start of the year, no new nasties. Mm-hmm. International, small improvement. UK, however, still undeniably tough. Last year's sales were flat. Operating profit was down by about a quarter. The dividend was cut, but interest covers 10 times. So you've got time on your side with the balance sheet. And this is a company with strong brands, a good historical record. And even when times are tough, it's still making, you know, 8, 9, 10% operating margins. So I think it is doing something right. But yet, you know, the licensing drive, international drive all helps. You probably do need the UK to show a little bit of signs of life, but at least we can afford to be patient. Mm-hmm. And the stock's, you know, still offering sort of 6% dividend yield, even when things are going pretty rough, and that's reasonably well covered.
Yeah, do you know what? I mentioned the 200-day moving average. This tested that back in December last year, and it didn't manage to get above it. It's come back now, and it's about to test it again. So again, you'll see whether it'll get above that. It's at 80 pence. If it breaks above 80 pence, really. Cool. What's next for us?
And the third and last one is RPS. So if anything, we've done three stocks this week, which are all had very difficult times and which are looking to bounce back from them. So we'll see whether it works or not. This is a support services company headquartered in Oxford. RPS, it's a FTSE small cap stock, actually dropped out the FTSE 250 in the last couple of years. 400 odd million market cap, and it was a mess. And the new chief executive, John Douglas, who came in 2017, said as much. He's now put in a new strategy, a new chief investment officer, new IT systems. He's doing a rebranding. And this business is best known for being an environmental consultant, for being an energy consultant. So the share price used to go up and down with the oil price. Now, you might think, well, hey, that's probably a good thing at the minute because the oil price is on the way up. But you don't really want to be holding to a commodity. And now energy is actually only 17% of the business. It does property consulting, energy, transport, water, resources, and government. And it's across health and safety, risk, planning, training, you name it. So it's not just an oil play now, or certainly that's how it doesn't want to be seen. But because of the changes that Douglas has made, there's been big investment in IT, in staff, in brand. And that meant last October there was a meaty profit warning for 2018 and 2019. That hammered the stock. But again, you've only got $74 million of debt, so debt to equity is only 20%. Good cash conversion, interest covers 10 times. There's a dividend yield well covered that's over 5%. So we can afford to wait to see whether the Douglas turnaround plan pays off. And again, from income seekers, it's worth looking at. There may even be capital potential if the turnaround starts to work out.
Do you know what? This chart is well, right? It's tussled. I mean, this of the last two, they've struggled with the 200-day moving average. This one has hit it, and it's just it came back a little bit. Now it's just broken through, and so it may find support from that now. So 190, and if it breaks £2, then it's a nice bullish thing. So this is one out of three that's managed to get past that sort of resistance level.
Okay.
You know?
Well, Meatloaf said 2 out of 3 ain't bad, but okay, one I'll settle for, and we'll see what happens with the others.
Marvellous. Thanks for that, Russ.
Take care. Have a lovely weekend.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. At five, it's Nuformix, NFX. At four, Volga Gas, VGAS. What's Nuformix there? It's down a little bit today. Volga is up 1.2. At three, MX Oil, up 31.3%. At two, Xeros Technology. News today. They signed a deal with a commercial washroom, one of the biggest in Southeast Asia, apparently, listed company. So, big deal. And of course, they've got the results that are coming out on Monday, final results. And number one, most followed company today is Wide Cells Group. That's WDC, of course, up 30% at the moment. All right, top five most liked RNSs came from the following companies. At five, Successful. Reconnaissance Drilling at Black Cat Gold, Prospect Victoria, Australia, ECR Minerals. At four, Prospect Oil and Gas, Resource Upgrade and Production Expansion Potential. At three, Angus Energy, Brockham Operations Update. At two, Rehoboth Resources, of course I chatted to Stephen. Well Commencement at West Newton Onshore UK. And number one, most liked RNS came from United Oil and Gas, significant upgrade to Italian resources. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Mucho appreciato.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.